Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Midnight Smoke by Helen Harper, narrated by Ruth Urquhart. Chapter 1. The door was exactly the same as I remembered it from my childhood. The varnish was a little more weather-worn, and there was more moss growing on the front steps than there used to be, but it was still the same familiar dark blue colour with its old brass knocker and barely legible nameplate. I drew in a breath and raised my hand to knock. I barely made contact when the door swung open and my uncle's craggy face peered out.
"Saw you coming from halfway down the street," he grunted. "I suppose you'd better come in."
There was no warm hug, brief peck on the cheek or handshake. He simply turned and shuffled into the house, leaving me to follow. I shrugged and wandered in after him. He moved more slowly than he used to, and his shoulders were more stooped, but the glacial way he greeted me made me almost nostalgic. In a way, it was comforting that some things never changed. I'd been meaning to make this trip for weeks, but work had always forestalled my plans. When I'd finally found myself with a spare morning, the first thing I'd done was set off, leaving early to avoid the worst of the rush hour traffic. I hadn't called ahead. Perhaps that had been a mistake. My uncle settled into the same worn armchair that had always sat in the corner of the living room, next to the overflowing bookshelves packed with biographies and treatises on global politics. Everything was the same, from the dusty rubber plant in the corner to the small flip calendar on the little table by the wall. I gazed at the date displayed on it in bold red letters, Tuesday, 22nd of June. It was hard to believe that it was summer already. My uncle sniffed loudly. He didn't offer me a cup of tea or a glass of water, but I hadn't expected him to.
"Got your birthday card?" he said.
I nodded. "You're welcome." His acknowledgement of the card was his way of saying thanks. He sniffed again and crossed his legs.
"How's life with the police?" he inquired. "Bagged yourself any criminals lately?"
"Several. And to answer your first question, I'm enjoying the job." His expression didn't change.
"Good."
Then,
"I suppose you're here because you're in some sort of trouble. Have you got yourself knocked up?"
I was 30 years old, hardly a teenager. If I did fall pregnant unexpectedly, not only would I be more capable of dealing with it myself, but he would be the last person I'd turn to for support. My uncle wasn't a bad man. He'd taken me in and ensured I was clothed and fed and had a safe roof over my head. The fact that he'd never shown up at school plays or read me bedtime stories wasn't his fault. He'd never asked to be saddled with a child, and I certainly didn't hold any grudges towards him. I'd received plenty of warmth and attention from my school friends' parents and various neighbours. In his own way, Wilfred Bellamy had done the very best that he could, and then, when I was 18, he'd sent me off, satisfied that his duty had been done. I'd kept in touch with him, but only with the odd postcard or Christmas greeting and very occasional visit. We weren't close, and never would be, but I'd come to terms with that long ago. I smiled faintly. "No," I said, "I'm not knocked up."
"Good,"
he said again. He fixed me with a beady stare.
"Why are you here, then?"
We were 2 hours out of London in a small village on the outskirts of Brighton. There was no chance that I'd happened to be passing and decided to pop in on a whim to say hello. He knew it and I knew it. That was one of those things that I liked about the cantankerous old bastard. He didn't waste time bothering to maintain a facade. He liked it when people got straight to the point instead of faffing around with niceties and politeness. Unfortunately, in this particular case, that was easier said than done. There were things about me that I was unwilling to say aloud, at least to my uncle, but I still had a lot of questions that only he could answer. "I'm here about my parents," I said softly.
"They're dead."
I gave him a long, exasperated look. "I want to know more about them. I don't remember very much."
"You were 5 when they died. You must remember some things."
Not the sort of things that were helpful. I remembered a warm, sunlit kitchen and a worktop strewn with flour as my mum and I baked together. I remembered running around a garden playing hide-and-seek with my dad. There were flashes of other memories, family meals, building a snowman, snuggling up together in front of a roaring fire. I knew I'd been loved. What I didn't remember was any mention of the supernatural, or the fact that I could die over and over again before being resurrected in flames. I didn't remember anyone ever telling me that I was a phoenix. No, I corrected myself. Not a phoenix, the phoenix. Infernal Enchantment, the book that I'd come across during the course of an investigation, had suggested there was only ever one, and currently, that was me. Did they ever have anything to do with soups? I asked. For the first time, my uncle looked surprised.
Vampires? He barked. Werewolves? Those sorts of people?
I nodded.
Your parents lived in Kent. We're talking English country garden stuff. He dismissed, not inner-city London shenanigans.
I know, I persisted, but...
I'd be surprised if either of them ever met a supernatural creature. But I wasn't close to them, as you know. Mark, your father, was 14 years younger than me. We didn't grow up together. I left home when he was 2. He was a snotty-nosed child with a predilection for plastic trucks. I didn't spend a lot of time with him, even when he grew older. As for your mother...
His mouth pursed as he thought.
Well, I only met her 2 or 3 times. I seem to recall she enjoyed painting. She had brown hair.
He pointed at me.
Same shade as yours.
Neither of those 2 things were helpful, but all my grandparents were dead, and my mother had been an only child. The only person in the world who could tell me about my parents was the uncle sitting in front of me. I wasn't going to give up yet. Do you have anything that belonged to them? I asked. Any diaries or notebooks? Any old belongings at all? His brow creased.
Why are you bringing all this up now? They've been dead for 25 years. What does it matter?
I didn't answer his question. Do you have anything of theirs? I repeated. He sighed and cast his eyes upward.
There might be a box, he said finally, up in the attic.
I sprang to my feet. Great, I'll go look for it. My uncle didn't move.
There's a lot of stuff up there. I have no idea where it would be, even if it's still there. I certainly don't want you rooting around in my possessions.
He wasn't making this easy for me. I'll be careful. He shook his head.
I will look for it and send anything I find on to you. I am a private person, Emma. I don't like having my routine or my home disturbed.
I was well aware of that. I considered arguing, but I didn't want to annoy him to the point that he shut me out completely. Okay, I said finally. I appreciate the effort. He knitted his fingers together and gave me a dark look.
What is this really about? He's not getting out, is he?
I knew who he was referring to. Samuel Beswick, the man who'd broken into my family home and murdered my parents, leaving me alone with their bodies. The crime had only been discovered when my wailing alerted the neighbours, although blessedly I remembered nothing of the event. Beswick had been arrested less than 24 hours after the double murder and had been in prison ever since. He'd never explained why he'd committed such a terrible deed, and he'd never admitted his guilt. But he was the reason I'd wanted to join the police in the first place. No, I said quietly. He's not getting out. Something gleamed in my uncle's eyes. There were occasions when it seemed to me that he despised Beswick far more than I ever could.
I'm pleased to hear it.
He stood up.
I'll look out that box for you.
I had the distinct impression that I was being dismissed. Thank you. I paused. How are you? I asked. Are you keeping all right?
A few aches and pains, nothing serious.
He pulled a face.
The worst thing about getting to this age isn't my health. It's the way everyone else treats me. I'm no longer seen as a real person. I no longer have a personality of my own. They see me as an old man who must be spoken to in a very loud, patronizing voice.
His lip curled.
I used to be considered important. I used to be respected. Now I'm just seen as old.
He pointed to the door.
I'll see you out.
I opened my mouth, wanted to say more, but he was already moving towards me and ushering me out. I knew that the last thing he wanted was my sympathy. He'd view it as pity, and neither of us wanted that.
There's no need to come back, he told me. I'll post whatever I find.
Translation: stop bothering me and interrupting my hermit-like existence. I sighed. Yeah, some things never changed. Then he surprised me. He reached out and took my hand, gripping it tightly. His skin felt papery and thin. My eyes flew to his, but I couldn't fathom his expression.
"Dredging up the past isn't always a good thing, Emma. Sometimes it's better to leave matters where they are and move on. What happened to your parents is a tragedy. What happened to you is worse, and I know that I was not the best guardian for you. But you can't change what happened."
I swallowed. "I'm not looking to change it," I said quietly. "I only want to understand it." He held my gaze before nodding.
"Very well."
He released his hold on me.
"They would have been proud of you, you know."
Unbidden tears rose behind my eyes and I blinked furiously. "Thank you." My uncle shrugged.
"I merely speak the truth."
Then he nudged me out of his house and closed the door. Rather than appreciate the opportunity to stretch her metaphorical legs on winding country roads, Tallulah had grumbled all the way to my uncle's house and all the way back. It wasn't until we reached the outer London limits that her engine stopped rattling. The lurid purple Mini, which I'd inherited from my Soup Squad predecessor Tony Brown, had considerable merits despite her age and tendency to belch out black smoke whenever she felt like it. Unfortunately, performing well on long drives was not one of those merits. I was beginning to think that she might have a point. The entire journey south felt like it had been a waste of time. We were crossing the river when my police radio crackled. It was so unexpected that I almost smacked Tallulah's bonnet into the rear end of the black cab in front of me. I was jerked forward, and the edge of the seatbelt cut into my skin. The taxi beeped its horn loudly. I breathed out. That was close. London taxi drivers were not to be messed with. The driver shot his hand out of his window and flicked his middle finger ostentatiously in my direction. I scowled. Whatever. It wasn't like I'd actually pranged his taxi. I glanced at my watch. Midday exactly. The morning had zipped by.
DC Bellamy, this is dispatch. Please acknowledge.
I fumbled with the equipment.
This is DC Bellamy.
I paused.
Acknowledged.
I winced at my awkward phrasing. I was rusty with a lot of terminology. As the only Soup Squad detective, I didn't spend a lot of time around other police officers. There was Fred, of course, but he'd been in Soup Squad longer than I had. I was the only detective. He was the only police constable. Lisa was counted as office support and didn't go out in the field. And although I'd made radio calls myself when necessary, I'd never received one before.
What is your current location? Your presence is required at the London Eye.
I glanced at the road.
I'm less than 10 minutes away. What's the problem? Suicidal vampire.
My mouth dropped open. Huh.
I'm on my way.
I changed lanes to adjust my course. A vamp with a death wish was the last thing I'd expected. I'd never heard of such a thing before, and no doubt Lucas, also known as Lord Horvath and leader of the London Vampires, would be apoplectic at the idea. He was also sure to be on the scene both to help his vampire and to manage what could only be vast numbers of avid tourists. I'd been avoiding Lucas for weeks, but I knew it was only a matter of time before our paths crossed again. I quashed the butterflies in my stomach and focused on recalling my academy training. Dealing with potential suicide attempts could be tricky. When such an attempt involved vampires and one of the most famous landmarks in the city, hell, anything could happen. Chapter 2. I parked as close to the London Eye as I could before jogging the rest of the way. There was already a police cordon around the area, but rather than preventing onlookers from pausing to gawk, it was only encouraging them. Truthfully, I'd have done exactly the same if I had been a passerby. I'd never seen anyone perched on top of a gigantic observation wheel before. The vampire in question wasn't in any of the glass-domed pods which were slowly revolving, affording visitors a panoramic view of the city. He'd forgone them in favour of clambering up the outside of the metal structure. How he'd achieved such a feat, which must have included evading the eye's security measures, was beyond me. Even for a vampire, it seemed nigh on impossible. I squinted at the ascending figure. He was dressed in black, and his hoodie obscured his face. I doubted that was by accident. I frowned and carried on towards the eye. I waved my warrant card at the first uniformed officer I came to, and he lifted up the cordon and gestured me through. I ignored the hum of curious questions from the crowd about my identity and walked quickly to the foot of the wheel. A man with a shiny bald pate, who was wearing a tailored suit that hung around his slight paunch, was flapping his arms and yelling. It didn't take a genius to work out that he was part of the London Eye's management team. The dripping sweat on his brow and his obvious panic broadcast it.
"You have to get that idiot down!" he shouted. "There are news crews here already. This isn't the sort of publicity we need right now."
Lord Lucas Horvath was standing less than a metre away. He didn't flinch. In fact, as far as I could tell, he was the epitome of cool, calm and collected vampire poise. He looked relaxed. His expression was bland and his arms were held loosely by his sides. His confidence was such that he didn't appear remotely out of place, even though he was wearing clothing that made him look as if he'd stepped out of the pages of a Victorian romance. I'd seen him wearing ruffled shirts before, but I'd never seen him wearing one that was open almost to his navel, with blood-red frills artfully sewn in so many places. His inky black hair had been blow-dried and was swept upwards from his face. On anyone else, that hairstyle would have looked ridiculous, but it suited Lucas perfectly. All he needed was a swooning woman in a corset hanging off his waist, and the picture would have been complete. "Fabio, eat your heart out." I glanced down at my jeans and plain T-shirt. If I'd known this was supposed to be a fancy dress party, I'd have taken more care. Truthfully, if I'd known I was going to be in Lucas's company, I'd have taken more care full stop. I couldn't deny my attraction to the vampire, and I couldn't allow it to go anywhere. Lucas's priority would always be the vampires, and I knew the vampires couldn't be trusted. They desired blood, power and sex, not necessarily in that order. After what had happened to me at the hands of my boyfriend, who had killed me twice, I wasn't willing to do anything that might jeopardise my fragile heart. But that didn't prevent the lurch in my stomach when I looked at the vampire lord.
"Are you suggesting, Mr. Hannigan?" Lucas inquired, "that the pages of tomorrow's newspapers are more important than a person's life. Perhaps we should hope for a gust of wind to knock the poor fellow off his perch. Then you can clean up the bloodied mess of brains and splattered internal organs while the tourists get back on board for their selfies."
Uh-oh. Usually Lucas could charm the pants off anyone he spoke to. The belligerent edge to his words spoke of his genuine anxiety about whoever was clinging to the observation wheel above our heads. I jumped forward before an argument ensued.
"Detective Constable Emma Bellamy," I said by way of introduction. "I'm with Soup Squad. I need to know what's going on here, then we'll see about the best way of talking that man down. Who is he, and how did he get up there?"
Lucas turned to me, his black eyes searching my face. What he was looking for, I had no idea.
"Hello, Emma," he said.
He moved a fraction closer.
"How are you?"
His tongue darted out and wetted his lips.
"You've been avoiding my calls."
I pointed at the wheel, ignoring his attempts at pleasantries. My uncle would have been proud.
"Who is that?"
If Lucas was irritated, he didn't show it.
"We haven't been able to get a decent look at his face, so I can't tell."
"But he's definitely a vampire."
"Yes."
Hannigan gestured towards a young woman wearing a London Eye T-shirt who was staring at Lucas with wide eyes. Considering the clothes he was wearing, I couldn't blame her.
"Paige," he snapped, "tell her what you saw."
When she continued gazing at Lucas, Hannigan nudged her.
"Paige."
The woman shook herself and focused on me. I estimated she was about 20. She was probably a student working at the Eye during her holidays. No doubt it was a good gig most of the time. She scratched her head and blinked rapidly.
I was getting ready to open up. When he came past me, half the security team were on his tail, but they couldn't get close. I tried to stop him too, but he was too fast. He's definitely a vampire. I got a good look at him and..."
She opened her mouth and tapped her canines.
"Fangs?"
I asked.
She nodded. "Big ones." "How do we know he's suicidal?"
I asked no one in particular.
"How do we know this isn't some kind of stunt?"
"Stunt?"
Lucas growled sharply. I gave him a long look. Just because he believed his vampires were above reproach didn't mean it was true. As their leader, he was powerful and he garnered considerable respect, but at the last count there were almost 2,000 vamps under his control. He couldn't possibly keep track of all of them.
If someone wanted to commit suicide, I said calmly, why would they choose such a public place?
Any bridge would do. Picking a tourist attraction seems like vanity.
Lucas's face darkened, but he didn't answer, probably because he knew I was right.
I don't care why he's up there, Hannigan said. Just get the blighter down.
Easier said than done. Tell me about the wheel. What do I need to know?
We've shut down the power, Paige told me. Obviously.
She pointed at the immobile glass pods. Some of them still contained people. Anxious faces were peering down at us, then up at the precariously perched vamp.
It's 135 metres high. It's not the tallest observation wheel in the world.
Hannigan's expression soured further.
Although it used to be, and, Paige continued, one revolution takes around 30 minutes.
I scratched my chin. I suppose you've already considered turning it back on and waiting for our would-be jumper to rotate to the ground.
We don't want to do anything that might provoke him to step off.
Or, Lucas added, his expression shuttered, fall off by accident.
He was halfway up before we managed to shut everything down, Paige said. I don't think he'll fall by accident. He seems pretty nimble.
She cast another wide-eyed look at Lucas.
Is that a vampire trait?
He glanced at her, then smiled slowly without taking his eyes away from hers.
It is. Typically we're more athletic and stronger than humans.
The intensity of his gaze increased. Paige was all but melting. I frowned. What exactly did he think he was doing? Hannigan's cheeks were turning a vicious shade of red. He was obviously immune to Lucas's obvious charms.
Get that freak down from there!
Lucas placed a hand on his arm.
Don't worry,
he murmured, power vibrating through his words.
Everything will be fine.
The London Eye manager opened his mouth, then closed it again as his body subsided.
Everything will be fine,
he repeated robotically.
Lucas, I warned. He raised an eyebrow.
What? You can't tell me that he didn't need calming down.
I tutted.
That's so cool,
Paige breathed. Yeah, yeah. I sighed and looked up again. What comes up must come down, I decided, one way or another.
Do you have any safety harnesses for climbing up the structure? I asked. They're being collected, Paige answered. They should be here soon.
Soon might be too late. I nodded before moving away and examining the web of steel. It didn't look too difficult, and fortunately I had a head for heights. I raised one foot and tested my weight.
Emma, Lucas said, what do you think you're doing?
I grinned.
I told you before, I prefer it when you call me D'Artagnan.
Then, without further ado, I started to climb. The watching crowd gasped loudly, a perfectly synchronized sound of excitement and horror. I'd barely gone 2 metres when Lucas was by my side, climbing with me.
I will ask the question again. What the fuck do you think you're doing?
I'm going to talk to your vampire and see if I can encourage him to come down of his own accord.
I reached for the next steel section and hauled myself up.
Don't be an idiot. You might fall.
He was keeping pace with me, higher and higher and higher.
I'm a vampire. I have preternatural abilities.
True,
I answered without stopping. But if you fall, you'll still go splat.
So will you.
I'll wake up again 12 hours later. You won't.
I paused. And, as it turns out, the more times I die, the stronger I become. So not only is this easier for me than you might think, but if I slip and fall, I'll be more powerful tomorrow. If you slip and fall, you'll be dead.
He's a vampire. He's my responsibility.
I represent Soup Squad, I replied easily. The responsibility is mine. You head down to your new friend. I'll take care of this.
There was a beat of silence. Lucas continued to match me step for step. I risked a glance down and estimated we were already about 40 metres up. There was still no sign of the harnesses. This had definitely been the best call.
Paige does seem like a lovely girl,
Lucas said finally.
Mmm.
A gust of wind rippled past, ruffling my hair and tugging at the frills on Lucas's shirt.
I wonder if she's single.
I didn't respond.
You look annoyed, D'Artagnan. Are you jealous?
Nope,
I said, 45 meters up now.
But you're trying to make me jealous.
Another beat passed.
Yes, he said. I am. You were supposed to come round to my house for dinner. I was disappointed when you didn't. I ended up being called to a meeting at Fairfax's place instead. It was very dull. If you'd kept our date, I could have avoided his pointless attempts at friendship.
I called you about that. I had to cancel because I had an assault in Lisson Grove to deal with. A daft human bloke was trying it on with some of the car wolves, and he ended up getting bitten. I had to make sure the paperwork was in order and double-check that all procedures were followed.
One werewolf bite wouldn't turn a human into a furry beast, but two might, and three separate bites would almost definitely do the trick. The werewolf clans were only permitted to turn a small number of people each year because their numbers were strictly capped by the 1901 Limiting Act. Accidental bites had to be carefully logged and communicated to all werewolves to avoid inadvertent repeats and accidental transformations. It was a process the clans took care of for themselves, but this had been the first opportunity I'd had to witness it firsthand. I couldn't pass that up. And, if I were honest, having an excuse to avoid dinner with Lucas had been a godsend. I was conflicted about him, both about my feelings for him and his activities as a vampire lord, so avoidance seemed like the better option. If that made me a coward, well, then so be it.
You're scared of me.
No, I answered. 60 meters, almost halfway. It's not you I'm afraid of. It's your job, especially when it's compared to my job.
Being lord is more than a job.
Yeah, I said sadly. That's what worries me.
Emma, Lucas began.
Something fell from above, clattering past us as it bounced off the steel structure of the eye. I stopped moving and stared down, tracking its fall.
What was that?
Lucas frowned.
I don't know.
He angled his head up.
Shit, he muttered. He's on the move.
I squinted against the sun and spotted the vamp above us. He seemed to be moving across the top of the wheel towards the other side, away from us.
Can you see his face?
I asked. Lucas had far better eyesight than I could ever hope for.
Can you tell who he is yet?
His voice was grim.
No, he knows we're here. He wouldn't be moving away otherwise. But he's not once looked back in this direction. It's like he doesn't want to be identified.
Suspicion nibbled at me. There was more to this than met the eye. I was sure of it.
I have a bad feeling about this, I muttered.
Yeah.
Lucas's jaw was set.
Me too. You should head down to solid ground.
So should you,
I retorted. I looked at the nearest pod. There was a large group of people inside, staring at us. I considered raising a hand to wave at them, but I didn't want to tempt fate. We were rather high up now, and despite my newly enhanced strength and stamina, I was starting to tire. This climbing business was harder than it looked. At the front of the pod was a young boy, perhaps 7 or 8 years old. His mouth was smeared with chocolate from the ice cream cone in his hand. With all the excitement, he seemed to have forgotten that he was holding it. Rather than gazing at Lucas and me, however, his saucer-wide eyes were trained on the figure above us. All of a sudden, he seemed to gasp. My head swung round, just in time to see the supposedly suicidal vampire leap down from the steel beam he was balancing on to the top of one of the other observation pods.
"Don't move!"
I shouted, throwing as much force into my voice as I could. The wind whipped away my words, and even with the keen hearing granted to his kind, I doubted the vampire had heard me. By my side, Lucas cursed. Then the vampire leapt down again, his hands catching another of the steel rods, and swung in mid-air for a moment. I was all but certain he was going to fall and plummet the 100 meters or so to his death. Instead, he dropped and lowered himself further down with astonishing speed. The wind gusted even harder. The vamp, who was still on the opposite side of the wheel, barely seemed to notice. He drew level with us, but didn't once glance over in our direction. He seemed intent on getting to the ground. In theory, that was a good thing, because nobody wanted him to jump, but I wanted to talk to him and find out what was behind this stunt. If he ran away before we reached him, there'd be a lot of unanswered questions to deal with. I had to follow suit. If he was clambering down, then so was I. I started to lower myself, but in my haste, my foot slipped. I let out a sharp cry. Within a heartbeat, Lucas was reaching for me and pulling me back up again. His hand curved around my waist, gripping me tightly, and he looked into my eyes.
"I tried to warn you, D'Artagnan," he murmured.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?